I'll begin with some comments, and then I hope that we can do some storytelling together, and whether we do that breaking up with partners or do it as a group, we can decide at that point in the session. Last night I talked about stories shaping our lives and the stories of the flood. The stories we're going to talk about tonight are stories from our heritage, the stories that are part of our oral tradition, which I'm sure Sister Rosina is what happens a lot in your country, in Ghana, with the oral tradition of stories. It's where the values and beliefs are passed passed on, excuse me, and handed down from earlier generations to, they're often used in many cultures to convey those beliefs and values that are important to families so that the younger people will continue to carry them on and into the next generations. The stories, families' stories, have a powerful hold over us, whether we like it or not. Sometimes I discover things about a family story that I didn't think that I carried on, and suddenly it surprises me, and it's there in a way that I have to deal with in some sense of acknowledging that it is a part of me as well. And I can change that in some way to fit who I am, but I cannot disregard or disconnect from many of the family stories that have been a part of my heritage. Now, I don't know where you are in the process of discovering more about your family stories. Maybe some of you have done genealogies and are into family trees and know a lot about your families and where you came from and the names that go back many generations. Anybody here that has done some of that? Have you done some?
I haven't done any, but my cousin, who happens to be a member of the LDS Church, has done a lot, I'm sure.
And what has it done for him or for you? What has happened with that when you start?
Well, we got interested in it and then went to Europe, Germany, where our, found out her grandfather and my grandfather were baptized in the same church. So we knew they were near each other over there. But
and to see their way they live is so much like our parents live.
You mean the topography they, or the way they live?
The way they live. Yes, and their habits of living are just very much like.
So did it feel like you were at home in a way?
Yes, it did.
We've gone there twice since then to visit people there.
And you discovered connections that you didn't know were there that surprised you.
I have a cousin who started, I didn't know I had this cousin, and she somehow way across the country met someone in another state who just heard the same name and connected up, and then she came and researched and got in touch with all of us, and it's incredible the similarities, just how she reminds me of myself in a lot of ways.
So there's a real linkage that goes back.
We did a funny thing happened when our second daughter was born. We decided to name her Magdalena after Mary Magdalene because she was due at Easter time and because Mary Magdalene was the first preacher of the Easter Gospel. And all my family, my sisters and brothers and parents, what a funny name. No one in this family has ever had that name. Where did you get Magdalena? And I said, well, I like it and I think it sounds nice. But they thought it was such an odd choice and that it sounded like it didn't fit somehow. Well, then, not too long ago, my parents went to Germany, and were received in the home of some second cousins, and were showing pictures of all their grandchildren, and they perked up that we, oh, you've got a grandchild, Magdalena. There's been a Magdalena in this family for every generation until this one. And there had been one in this generation, a generation of my children, and we're so delighted it's been carried on. So suddenly now she has a family name. And it was a story that has given her name, years later, a kind of meaning to her. Mm-hmm. And she'll say, it's been every generation in my family in Germany.
Sister Rosina, how would you explain that in your country? That somehow, without knowing that this child is named a family name?
Well, given the background of our culture, it will never happen.
It would never happen.
But somehow, the way it will actually happen will be that there will be a cousin who has maybe traveled far away from home, and then will come home and has named the same name. And so the children bear the same name when they come home. It will be the same name as though they were still there at home. Because of the way they teach you as you are coming up, they give you the history because it's oral culture. So I'm sitting here carrying a lot of history inside me about the families, the same as all my sisters and brothers. So I'm trying to be, maybe when I get a chance, write them down.
And I think that's important. And what I'm really interested in this series is to begin to help you understand the importance of claiming those stories, claiming the stories of your family, and we'll go on to claiming stories of your own, the different strands of your life, stories of place and stories of change. Because the stories are your story. They're your life, your identity. And it's ongoing. We continue to live out stories of who we are. We start with the family stories that help to give us a base, a common kind of ground, and you take it from there and make our stories drawing on that. There are many cultures, as Sister Rosina talked about in her culture. The Native Americans, I'm always fascinated by the artworks of Native Americans and how the functional pottery or baskets or whatever that also tell stories about who they are and their culture and pass on some of the values and beliefs of their culture. In the Southwest, we were there recently in Santa Fe, and there's so many different Native American nations, pueblos there. And I love the story, storytellers that are made by some of the pueblos. Each of the pueblos has their own style of storyteller. And the storyteller in the different nations is a very important role, a very important person who carries on some of the tradition. Leave that out for you want to look at it.
There's a book available in the bookstore as well, a children's book, that is a story about the storyteller lady and her beginnings. And so it's a lovely weaving of one story inside another that demonstrates how it isn't fact always that bears the truth of a story.
Yes.
The truth is born. It's a truth-bearing story. Does not need to be historically factual.
Exactly.
But this is a beautiful little children's book on this tradition.
And I love the way she has the children on her lap and on her back, and just surrounded by children be talking about that later this evening, about children, how inclusive they are in the storyteller's role and carrying on a tradition. When you talk about a story doesn't have to be so factual or have literally factual, that the spirit and kind of essence of the story, it changes in the telling, and it changes for different people when they tell their story. Actually, some memoirs, we're in a period now where stories are really kind of mushrooming, the idea of stories, and there are a lot of memoirs and autobiographies being written. They're very popular now. But some of the memoirs that come out may not be as factual. We think of them as fact and different from fiction, but there may be changes in the memories and in the way people write their memoirs. Trudy Bush, who wrote an essay recently in the Christian Century, maybe some of you read that, where it was entitled Putting a Life in Order, she argues that memoirs are not necessarily more true than fiction, for the writers try to shape their lives into a satisfying pattern. Through memoirs, the writer presents herself as she wishes to be seen. So it's not necessarily altering the truth, but it's leaving out or being selective of what pieces then are passed on. And Bush contends that this does not mean they're less valuable, that the memoirs are less valuable, but because they still present a vision of life's possibilities. And a good memoir makes us feel that we can find and articulate the significance of our own lives. So they still are of service in our lives. One thing that happens along this line is leaving out, when you're selective in writing memoirs, many people leave out some of the difficulties or the problems or pain in a family. I have a friend that who came upon recently a memoir written by his uncles and his father. And I asked him how much of the struggles they had and the pain that they experienced, the failures, which are part of human experience. And he said there was very little in there, but he knew that that was a part of their lives from some of the family stories. So there was a selectivity of what is passed on, even though the oral tradition may pass on some of the other stories. And in reading or hearing family stories, we often discover some pattern of meaning that connects in some way with our own lives. As we talked about last night, when you listen to somebody's story, there's often a connection where you have an aha moment of saying, yes, I've been there, or I know that, or that applies to me too. That sense of connecting then, a kind of inner truth that is there, that is part of you as well as part of the storyteller. Another way to carry on stories is diaries. And every now and then we read about diaries. I think there have been quite a few published over the past several years, particularly of women. Women from immigrants, from frontier days. Any of you read diaries from women or men? I think they would be more factual because they would be a daily kind of noting of what was happening in a person's life. And so they might also include some of the difficulties Yes.
And usually, when you write the diary, you don't plan on publishing.
On publishing, yes. So, a good point. It's more personal. It's something that is for your sake. And
I remember at the 50th anniversary of the publishing of the first publishing of Anne Frank's diary, mm-hmm. it was finally revealed that her father, before releasing her diary, had edited it, mm-hmm. had taken out particularly sexual feelings that she had toward one of the other occupants of the attic, and physical descriptions, especially about her menstruation. And so the father edited his own daughter's diary, but at the 50th anniversary, it was agreed that the whole diary now is available, unedited. There's an interesting, just what you're saying, mm-hmm. at 50 years ago, for a young girl to talk about mm-hmm. those things, mm-hmm. And maybe he was protecting her privacy, too.
It may be.
And I haven't seen the unedited version yet of the diary of Anne. Has anyone seen Anne Frank's unedited?
I wonder if it would add anything anyway, if that's what that was left out.
Pardon?
I mean, the hard-hittingness of the story, I don't know if that would add much to the
but
story.
There, well, I... that we need to remember she was a burgeoning sexual creature, too. Yes. I mean, she became a young woman during
yes.
those years.
That's her whole life, you're right.
It's mm-hmm.
And she had human feelings,
yeah.
and as a woman, and a young woman. Mm-hmm.
Henry Nouwen did a diary too that was published. The Genesee diary, as well as the one he did in Latin America. Mm-hmm. There is another diary mm-hmm. called, it's in Spanish. The title is in Spanish, but it says it means thank you or something like that. But it's day-to-day recordings. From how he felt, the whole, you know, process of everything.
But a Henry Nouwen mm-hmm. might expect his diary would be published. More than an Anne Frank.
Another way we see of people telling their stories is through art. Maybe some of you are familiar with the artist Jacob Lawrence. Mm-hmm. We just saw a exhibit of his in, let me see if I remember the town of, just north of Seattle. It's a little kind of an artist colony.
Laconia?
Yes, I think that's it. Mm-hmm. And they have a lovely little museum there, and they had an exhibit. The Migration series was not in there, but some other of his paintings were. He has a kitchen series that is wonderful, and John Brown series. He tells a story about John Brown. The Migration series is about the migration of the blacks from the South to the North in the early part of the industrial era, when they needed more workers in the factories. And his style and his starkness of line, and, it's beautifully done without just a little caption under each, but you get a sense of what was happening with the people in each of the pictures. Our historical society in St. Paul had a workshop, actually, at the Minnesota History Center on families. And they got together a variety of people to talk about families and use the book We Grew Up Together, Adult Brothers and Sisters in 19th Century America, which is by Annette Atkins, who is a professor of history at St. John's University, exploring the again, the roots and the resources. Another way is to look at old photographs. I know that we don't take time, enough time, to look back, even at the stories, the photographs of our own immediate family. But we have inherited several old photographic books from from parents and aunts and uncles. And they're wonderful ways. You don't always know who they are anymore, some of them, because the people aren't around to tell us, but we do have some of the names. And I'm going to show you a family in my, that is part of my heritage. This is, on my mother's side, there were 8 sisters and 2 brothers. She was 1 of 8 and 2 brothers. And they lived on a farm. They were sturdy Norwegian stock. Parents emigrated from Norway. And it was a family like so many families of that era, that the older ones helped the younger ones. And it was a sense of real community in that family and in within the larger community. The 8 sisters were very sturdy, independent women. There were 3 nurses, 3 teachers that came out of that group, all very independent, and all of them had very interesting lives. And when I look at this picture, it evokes all sorts of stories for me. I could tell a story about each one of them to begin with, and many stories, and stories of when we got together as at family reunions, and when we were little, how the aunts would immediately switch to Norwegian every time they didn't want the younger children to hear what they were talking about. And we knew then that we were sort of listening in pretty closely at that point, but we couldn't get it because we didn't know Norwegian, and they knew that. So there was a definite division there. At this point, there are only two of those aunts left. One is in her mid-80s, and one is 91. So the heritage, any questions that we still have, we don't have much time to explore. And on that note, a cousin of mine and I, about 5 years ago, decided to explore some of the family stories from this family. And we took a Amtrak train in the middle of winter and went to Minot, North Dakota. And I'll never forget these two twin aunts. There were 2 sets of twins in this family, one identical and one fraternal. And these two twin aunts in their fur coats and high, fashionable black leather boots and long, flowing gray hair that was kind of kinky curly, stood there on the platform to greet us. And that picture will always stay in my mind. We spent 2 days with them and 2 nights, and we had arranged to come with our tape recorder. And we looked at old photo books, and every picture was a story. And we had the tape recorder going and asked questions. And they're both good storytellers, but the one on Agnes was especially good. She has, I think, a photographic memory, and she talks a mile a minute. And you just press a button and she's off running with another story. So we have all that. We have all that on tape. And it was really a wonderful occasion, and one that I will treasure. I don't know what I'm going to do with those stories, but they're there for me to listen to again and again. And but I realized the many different connections as they were telling the stories. I found out things about my family, my parents, when they were telling them, and much of what they talked about, I can claim as a part of my heritage. Yesterday, Vern and I attended Linda's session on interplay. Sister Rosina was there too. She called it Narnia for Adults. It was wonderful. She very artfully helped us get more connected with our physical body. And in doing so, we also were connected with our whole self, mind, body, spirit. I think she's going to offer it again. We told her she had to do it. So if she does, don't miss it. At one part of it focused on the hand. And first we did a sort of exercise with just our own hand as an individual. And it was a self-discovery. But then we did it in relationship with somebody else, which was a whole nother moving, very kind of spiritual dance. It was a connecting with the self when we did it individually, a kind of prayer meditation, and it was also a connecting with the other person when we did it with another. And I had a strange experience this morning. I was musing on family stories and the connections, and the image of hands just hit me very powerfully. And what I got in touch with was the memory of my father. And he had wonderfully large hands. He was a small town banker. His father had been a carpenter. My dad liked to do some carpentry projects, but his hands always interested me. And he died about 7 years ago at the age of 94 and a half. He died in a nursing home, and he was dealing with a multiple myeloma on his lower jaw, which just sort of took over the whole side of his face. But he was very calm about that and never complained as it became more distorted and grew. He kept very interested in the lives of others, in our lives and in world events, and could talk about all of that. In fact, a few weeks before his death, he discussed with his grandson whether he should do his PhD thesis on Vietnam or Cambodia. But his hands really interested me. And I held those hands a lot during the last week of his life. He told me that he only had a few days left to live. He died within 5 days after that. And those last days, I sat by his bedside, and at first the hand was warm to the touch, and there was still strength in that hand. And I could hold it, and we could talk. And one day I came, and he was reaching up with the hands, like it was like he was reaching for something. And he couldn't talk by that time. But his eyes were following his hands, and they went up like this. I'll never forget that. As if there were something or someone there. And when he couldn't speak any longer, he could still squeeze my hand when I asked him if he heard what I was talking about. And I would continue to talk and tell him conversations that we had had, or the family members that were coming, or what the day was like, because that was always important to him. So I talked to him as I always did. And I would ask him if he heard it, and he could just put a little pressure. So I knew that he heard, because hearing is the last sense to go. The hands became very transparent. I could almost see through them. And gradually became cold and still. And I held those silent hands in mine as the last breath was taken and the last pulse felt. And in the sadness of his departure, I felt a tremendous sense of gratitude for this man and for the life he had lived. And that he was my dad. Memories of that departure and of his life and the many stories he told came back to me today, and it surprised me. It really surprised me. But it was evoked by what we did with the hand yesterday and how powerful that image is for me. I have a poem that I'm going to read. I love to read poetry, and I usually read poetry when I'm doing these sessions. So I'm going to read a poem on Sometimes the Hand, written by a friend of mine who is a poet. In midnight's curve, hands open, close around sleep. Fingertips dream of parrot feathers, gritty figs, need sticky touch, fine pimento flavors hidden in each swirl of unmatched prints. The left does not know the right. Left hand clasps and pulls at green satin word dreams, clips them like charms upon the bracelet of the right hand's wrist. The right hand keeps heirloom rings, family pieces. Fingers of the right know how to add and tally the cost. My fingers are patchwork gathered from the bag of smallest family bones. Mother's tapered digits, father's downy knuckles, grandfather's narrow palm and grandmother's nails, waved and unhappy with themselves, always needing slim tending with crescent scissor blades. And there are others, quiet in the creases. I hold pen differently than any teacher would claim having taught. Middle fingers callous is witness to misfit childhood pressed around written words. As a girl, I tried to chew it off, wore many bandages. Now I trust this part of my body. It is growing. One day it will be hard for my fingers to work as a community of 10. Impossible to hold all you give them. Something is certain to cut like bladeless and even sharper paper, or slip into the finger like a splinter. The taste of blood is important after teeth have pinched out splinter. Mouth sucks, and when taste of thorn gushes into taste of flesh, infection has no chance. Age shrinks small bones. They float like kindling beneath parchment skin. I was young when I learned to pass index finger low and even through candle flame. It did not burn. I helped the nurse wash my father before he died. I did not look at my hands, did not plunge my hands into death's sweat, could only touch, could not embrace or hold it off for a moment. His hands were cupped cold, could have carried without spilling water and wine mixed above lifeline, jagged heartline, soft mound of Venus, full of meaning I have forgotten and am almost afraid to remember. I need no fortune teller. I believe in fate have held its hand often. In old movies, the skeleton's hands are intact. Point at greedy grave robbers who run in tripping horror. It really is not like that. Hands are among the first to go. Arched moons above cuticles crumble to stillness. Black juice of joints ache and return to the earth. No glove can comfort.
These hands do not separate food from hunger, earth from seed. They carry orchid to nose, bread to lips, oil to aching limbs. No caraway from fennel seed, but cannot distinguish color. My fingers pick out threads, a ritual for a seam, a fingered prayer. Each finger making a prayer is a prayer flag lifting cries to the ears of the goddess as she awakens. Pray now, quickly, and sleep. So I invite you to participate with some of your stories. And I think we're going to have to, well, we can decide whether we do it in pairs or do it just as a group. Which would you prefer? Pardon?
I would like pairs.
Pairs, okay. Two things to remember in the process. So why don't you find a partner, and there are two things in the process, the telling of the story and the listening to the story. Both are very important. The listener means active listening. It means being present to the teller, so that you don't interrupt, but you listen to what the person is saying. And then you change positions and be the teller and the other person, the listener. And as a listener, be aware of the places that you find pieces of your own story in hearing the teller's story. So why don't we take, just relax and take a deep breath. And if you want to close your eyes for a moment, take a deep breath and relax. And just allow your mind to wander. And the spirit to cruise, and so that a family story finds you. It may come through a sensory mode, a visual image. There may be a special taste or aroma or sound or action or touch. But allow a story to find you. Something that has been a part of your family history. It may have special meaning to you. Okay, if you have your story, then find a partner and decide who's going to be the teller and who the listener. And maybe take about 4 or 5 minutes for each person. And I can give a little ding or something when it's when it's time to change. Maybe those that are have come together will want to share the story with somebody else. Okay? Fine.
She washed her hair. I was just down, I closed the door.
daughter's chemo.
We thought that somebody had just these rehearsals. And that she was soft.
If you could finish your stories and we could just have a little wrap up at the end. Tape turned off. Does anybody have any objections to turning it on again? If somebody talks about what happened in their story, would you prefer not? Or oh, is it okay, people? Okay, tape rolling again. For the tape audience, we have had about 10, 15 minutes of people dividing into pairs and sharing stories with each other. And we turned off the tape during that time. We're gonna do some processing of that at this time. What was that like for you? It happens, doesn't it? And it was like, I hated to turn you off. Like, we should have had another 15, 20 minutes or an hour or whatever, because once the stories start rolling, it evokes more memories and could continue on for another hour or more.
Mm-hmm. It's like your tongue loosens up your brain.
Right? The tongue loosens up the brain. Any surprises on the story that you picked? Or that picked you?
Yeah, maybe for myself. My story it surprised me that it picked me, because you had just commented that most people sort out the bad things, mm-hmm. but they don't tell those. And my story was about conflict.
Mm-hmm. How was that for you to talk about that?
Well, I guess it's been so much a part of my life. That it really didn't bother me that
good.
Much.
Mm-hmm. Because the conflict is so much a part of our human experience too, and we need to work through that and incorporate that as a part of who we are, as a part of being human. Anybody interested in telling their story or telling parts of their story? First, did anybody hear parts of your own story when the other person was telling theirs?
Well, part of my husband, I've heard my husband's family stories. He sometimes more than mine. Hears from me a lot of it.
So you got pieces of it when you were listening to her story? Mm-hmm. Anybody else find pieces of their own story?
Yes, I thought of a similar experience that I had as a child when she told her story. So, brought back memories of my own childhood.
Mm-hmm. So it evoked memories for you of that, and are these memories that you haven't thought about for a while, or they've kind of been pushed to the background, or?
No, not really, but it was kind of neat that this, I would have probably not thought of it. It would have not picked me, as she put it, at this time. So it was pushed back, but I don't think because I suppressed it or...
No.
It just, it kind of got me lost a little bit.
So, so it was a connecting link.
I think what was interesting for me was when she told that and shared her feelings about it, I had the impulse of jumping in and telling my own story. And I think that's really important to remember that, it's listening time now for you when someone else tells their story to you. I find that sometimes difficult, and I see that it's difficult for other people to.
I think it's a common occurrence where when we hear somebody telling us a story, that when we have a story of our own that's similar, sometimes people jump right in, in the middle of it, and so the person telling the story doesn't have a chance to even finish. And that kind of leaves it hanging, or it feels like my story isn't as important, or you're not interested in listening to my story if it's only going to evoke some story of your own. So it is important to practice this, because I don't think we do this as much. We're used to kind of jumping right in and telling our own stories about something. But the art of listening, of being present to a person and allowing them to tell the story and listening, not conjuring up my own story while I'm, think I'm listening to the other person, which happens a lot too. So I'm not really listening or with one ear only because I'm thinking of what I'm going to tell them. It's an art that can be practiced, and it honors the person that's telling the story. Mm-hmm. Honors the story. And then in turn, the other person will honor your story. So I guess maybe we don't have time for anything more. Anything else that you want to say about this? We'll do some more in the next few days. Tomorrow we'll be talking about stories of our own lives and finding a particular strand or thread that we want to follow in telling our story. The next day will be on stories of place. The book I would like, which is in the bookstore, some of you might have read it, by Kathleen Norris, Dakota. You know about that? She's a wonderful writer, and it's called A Spiritual Geography. So it really fits with the stories of place, but it's also a story of coming back. She lived in New York, and she's a writer. She's written several books and came back to live in the Dakotas, and what that was like for her to re-enter her roots and
the people and the practices and the whole patterns of life there. She writes very well on that, and I think you would enjoy it. Willa Cather says there are only two or three human stories, and they go on repeating themselves as fiercely as if they had never happened. So I leave you with that. That we have variations on themes, but our stories are so overlapped, and they're about, you think about it and tell me what you think about it if you come back tomorrow. Okay, thanks for coming and for sharing your stories with each other. And I hope you continue to think about your stories and validate them and to learn more about your family stories and perhaps write them down and for your children or grandchildren so that they too know something about their heritage.